And now,
from the didgeridoo to 140 miles east of Kalamazoo, at least as far as Google Maps says, this version is a tribute to Motown.
Chill Pack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lernis.
From Los Angeles, this is Phil Lernis, what's left of him, and the man cackling at my expense is the Motor City Madman. It's Motown's very own Dean Haglund. How are you, Dean?
Hooray! Hey, everybody. How you doing, Phil?
Oh, my God. Why are you Cowboy Dean all of a sudden?
That's Michigan.
Is it really? It's like the Wild West there.
Wild West out here. It's freezing cold. You got to wear your chaps indoors. That's how cold it is.
Darling, you are finer than a new set of snow tires. That's the kind of Detroit cowboy that you are, my friend.
That's what's happened. It's all gone to hell.
So, speaking of gone to hell, I maintained a fairly positive attitude about going blind here because
you have to.
No, you really don't. There are alternatives that are, it turns out, quite enjoyable in the brief. Anyway, but I knew when I was going to be seeing the surgeon, and I just figured, well, you know, at the very least, I'll get more concrete answers. I'll have some timeline idea, and I'll just hold on till then. But at the same time, the fear factor was affecting me. In no small way. I mean, I really was staying indoors. I wasn't going anywhere. I wasn't doing anything. Right. I didn't even go to the Breakfast Club last week because the week before it really. I mean, people would come up and talk to me, and it's like pink blobs coming out of pools of milk, pink blobs coming out of pools of milk, calling out my name and me not having any idea who they are. And then my eyesight got bad. see what I did there. So anyway, so it just it was affecting me. It was building up in me, but I was maintaining a positive enough attitude. And then the night before, afternoon before my appointment with the surgeon, the clinic calls to cancel my appointment.
Damn it.
Emergency has cropped up. And I threw a not inconsiderable emotional fit.
On the phone? Or did you wait to hang up?
No. On the phone with many people. So many people are dealing with worse than me. So many people have dealt with worse than me and have confronted this very thing. My own sister, who, as you'll recall, had a major stroke a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. And the good news about the stroke, I guess, was that they were able to discover at that time a significant tumor in her throat. Right. And what she experienced for a long time. First of all, obviously, they couldn't perform surgery because she wasn't strong enough following the stroke. And then, so they had to wait for that. But then it was well more than a year of setting up, scheduling it, and then it getting canceled. And she does not live anywhere near the Stanford Medical Center, so it was no logistical walk in the park getting her there. And so this was, you know, aggravating to say the least. And then, of course, before you have surgery, you know, there's a whole battery of tests that have to be performed to make sure, I don't know why they have to. You know, it's like you got to get your oil checked every 50,000 miles before a surgery. And but so every time they would cancel it, then that meant that she had to go back to this previous station and get all come in to get all these tests done in advance. Oh, so brother. That she could then get from the insurance the go-ahead to have the surgery. So anyway, in this moment when I find out that my appointment's canceled, and this is the first time since I've been going through this that something like this has cropped up. Pretty much everybody has been on top of contacting me saying, we have an opening, can you come in now, and doing it. But in that moment, I saw everything that she went through. And I projected that into my future. and it was really an abyss emotionally. And so all this stuff that I'd been holding at bay came out. And my eyesight's really dramatically deteriorated over the last couple of weeks. And so it's... So I let them know. And in retrospect...
I let them know. That's great.
Greg DeBellis, our composer on The Lady Killers and The Truth Is Out There, he has, in the last couple of years, beat cancer. And he let me know that I did absolutely the right thing, making sure they were on the receiving end of the emotional impact it was having on me. Because... I was able to make it emotional for them. There was emotional stakes involved in this. And so the good news is that instead of 3-week postponement before I see the surgeon, and who knows, right, if that would even then happen, I am getting the very first appointment when she comes back. So it'll be this Thursday, knock on wood. And although... you know, this is for me disappointing news. At least news is helpful. But I had this idea that if I could have seen the surgeon last week, I mean, I had this fantasy that she would look at it and go, "Oh, you know what? We can clean this up right now. Let's get you into the chair."
Here's the laser, pew pew.
And but I knew that we were going to have to reschedule and you know, schedule the two different surgeries and. But I had this idea that by the end of May, I would be seeing better. And they let me know that the earliest, you know, no promises, but really, I shouldn't expect that these surgeries could take place before the end of June.
Yipsters. But wait a sec. You live in a city of 14 million people. Surely there's another surgeon in that vast metropolis who also could see you and do this work.
Yeah, but I feel that, and this is what they kind of leveled with me, they were absolutely fine with making another, you know, referral and all of this. But because it all has to go through insurance, how many steps back? It's like, you know, a board game. Like, how many moves do you lose?
Yeah, right?
And
I guess, I'm too used to that Australian thing where you just walk in and go, hey, I'll get that done, please.
Well,
and
as an emergency, I probably could, but I...
Well, doesn't being blind constituted...
Yeah, exactly. Well, this is why it's covered by insurance, because they, you know, eye care is not covered by insurance in this country, nor is dental. The two things that really ought to be covered the most, dental and eye... you know, people don't understand this, but you know, those really are the two most important for your health. Those are what are not covered by American insurance, you know, unless you pay extra for it. But those are not the basics. But this is covered because they do acknowledge that going blind does not lead to you being a taxpayer. So that's the reason that it
that's pretty good
that it happens. So I plumbed the depths for a couple of days. And now this week, I'm determined to just live as normally as I can. Going to do a coaching later today. Going to have a lunch meeting with our friend Chris Hammond tomorrow. Going to go to the Breakfast Club and see the pink blobs that I love so dearly. And, you know, so.
And maybe you need a seeing eye puppy, huh? What about that?
I got a seeing eye cat, but we see exactly the same way. So,
yeah, and nocturnally.
Although, oddly enough, she looks towards the more Western philosophers and I look towards the more Eastern philosophers, but we do see the same things. See what I did?
Well, yeah, maybe you should just go out at night. You ever think of that?
I have. I mean, that's what I do. And really, the halo on all the lights now, that's one of the ways in which it really has, you know, a couple few weeks ago, maybe a month ago, nighttime was perfect. Like, I could see perfect. Now, like, I don't know, you know, if you look down the street at, like, a red light at a traffic signal, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Does it, the question is always, does it have a halo? Because that's a sign of cataracts.
Right.
The question actually is that 50-foot red ball in the sky, does it have a traffic signal in there? Yeah, because it's the light is, in terms of size, that red traffic signal is enlarged by a factor of 50. Probably in my vision.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it's it's good fun. It's good fun. But I did, again, forcing myself to go out, I actually went to see a movie, first movie I've seen projected since January 13th. Because it's just so difficult. I mean, it was only the second one that I've seen this year. And
how did it look?
And first, I don't know how I made it down. I went to the Vista. I don't know how I made it down there. Literally, I walked over. You know how tree roots will make sidewalks buckle and, you know, lift up the. I walked over some of that was like walking through war-torn Beirut, and I couldn't see any of it coming. And I have no idea, but like none of it. I didn't trip. I didn't have any. I guess I was just so focused at the task of walking by faith and not by sight that nothing could fell me.
You have no neighbors? No. What's Lily doing? She can't walk with you?
Can you walk me to a movie? And then I've been walking myself places, you know, I was 30. I mean,
yeah.
Making my own lunches since I was 40. And
I know, with your own eyes, though. That's just the thing.
Anyway, so I'll talk about how the movie, you know, never have I struggled so much to see so little, and I'll let that linger there for a while, and we can see, is he talking about the movie or his eyesight, or could it be both?
Right.
Or maybe even neither. Breaking news, Dean, this morning, and I didn't have time to really prep for it, and I didn't think we could really do justice to it, but Doris Day died.
Oh.
And it's fair to call Doris Day an icon, right?
It is fair, yes.
Because
I'm surprised she was still alive, actually. I thought,
you know,
how old was she?
97. And you know,
wow.
I think the reason is it's surprising because you think, my God, she was an icon of the 50s and 60s. And really of an entire genre of films. She really was iconic in that. And I really thought she was a terrific singer. She is one of my favorite songs of all time she recorded. But so you think, well, that's... Look, I've been watching the first season of Patrick McGoohan's Danger Man, and I had never watched these before. I had seen the hour-long version, of course. I was a big fan of that, as well as The Prisoner. But he did this half-hour series originally, years before, and this is actually worth talking about. One of the creators of it was Ian Fleming, and this is 1960.
Wow.
This is 2 years before Dr. No. And so, you know, the Bond, James Bond?
Yeah.
That starts with Drake, John Drake. That's in, yeah. And, so it's really interesting. But in the first series of it, not just season, but truly, even in the American sense, a series of it, because it was produced in England, shown here on CBS, but 39 episodes. And that's 1 year. Yeah, that's 1 year. 39 episodes. Half hour shows. A drama suspense show at a half hour just seems so odd to our modern sensibility.
Yeah, for sure.
But it's 26 minutes each show. And I got to tell you, for economy of scale, for a suspense and action and mystery show, 26 minutes is kind of perfect. It's, you know, and
you got to pare it down,
and 90 minutes is perfect, you know, right. But what's wrong is where we're at now, which is the 40 minutes,
right?
Because 40 minutes isn't a full hour. It's not enough for an hour. It's basically a half hour with padding. So anyway, they're really exciting, tense, taut shows, introducing Patrick McGoohan, as it says. And, we can talk about more of the delights of it in the future and the differences, but it is amazing. He plays a NATO agent who's Irish American, and when the show runs for a couple years, but CBS won't kick in. They make it over 1 year there in England, but CBS won't kick in production funding, so they don't go back into production on it. Then right. James Bond happens,
right.
And all around the world, Danger Man gets sold into syndication. So it's now this huge hit. So they bring it back, but they bring it back as an hour show. And now he's a British secret agent with a British accent. Played by the same guy with the same name. So it's really funny. the retconning that went on then. But anyway, the reason I brought this up was realizing, holy shit, this is 60 years old. And it's still exciting, and it speaks to today in some really astounding ways. And the people that show up on this show, it's great fun to see. But so 60 years, and so this dialing it back to Doris Day and you being surprised that she was still alive.
Right.
Well, that's it. You go, oh my God, she was an icon. She was an icon 60 years ago.
Well, I know. Think of that, eh?
But I think it's also fair to call her iconic because she became an icon in the animal protection movement.
Right. I remember seeing her in a t-shirt that says, love animals or I kill you, something like that.
Well, much like Tippi Hedren, right?
Yes. And the Shambhala Reserve of lions.
She traded her fame and her fortune and her influence towards the betterment of conditions for animals, and her name would come up regularly for me within those circles, and so I think it's fair to say that she maintained icon status. It just shifted into a new realm, so anyway, we'll talk about her more next week, what she represented, right. What she was as a performer, and all that stuff. Before we move into actually opening the Chilpack Morgue for this week, you did an interview in Digital Journal about technology and about the Lady Killers.
Oh yeah,
this sounds like it's news to you.
Yeah, no, I did. Yeah, for sure. It was delightful, and man. No sooner than I hung up the phone than I swear I get an email going, articles published. I have to hand it to Marcos, the interviewer, for the speed at which he brought our conversation up to a published journal piece.
News at the speed of sound. Marcos, you can use that as your motto. You have my permission.
Fantastic. No, it was great. Did you read it? I don't know if I read the whole thing, actually.
So let me explain something to you here. I'm having a little bit of a problem with my eyes.
Oh, yeah, that part.
Oh, my God. One part that really lit the barn doors on fire was when the organizer woman, this did push her into a more compassionate place. when okay. she was getting frustrated with my frustration and said, "Well, you're free to look for another surgeon." And wow. I said, "Ma'am, I find it really in poor taste when I'm sitting here blind that you're suggesting I look for anything."
That's a zinger.
Yeah, and that changed things a little bit.
Well, I would think.
So yeah, no, it was he got in, he got the job done. Who knows? Maybe it'll help some people learn about the Lady Killers that didn't know about it before. We got a really fascinating review from Film Threat this weekend. Out of the blue.
Really?
Yeah.
Film Threat. I remember Film Threat.
Yeah, they're back, and they're really supporting indie film. And, Film Threat and I have a history.
Yes, they are known for some of their more comedic, some let's say, snarky reviews on various films, if I recall, back in the day. In the 90s.
Maybe you are thinking of the one where they said Phil Lernis by name represents a new crisis in cinema.
That's the one, the new crisis in cinema.
And but you know, you live long enough, Dean. So here's a movie. So they give it a positive review. I give it, I think, 3 out of 5 stars. And but I get a glowing review.
What?
About like how impressive I am as a filmmaker and how I am audacious at a time when everybody's chicken shit.
Hey.
And so it actually felt pretty good. It felt pretty good. What was fascinating about the review was he really like got it. Like he was disgusted and uncomfortable watching the movie for the first 2 acts and really liked the movie because of that fact. And but it was interesting because he understood it was satire and that the job was to make the person, you know, to be uncomfortable. And
right.
So he got it, and he got the anti-misogyny message, the Me Too sensibility before there was Me Too. And really championed it for all that. What was fascinating was he took the film down a couple of marks for what other reviewers and other people who watch it love the most. He found Act 3 to be just melodramatic. And it's interesting because I find Act 3 to be really funny. And of course, many people who sit there, that's when the laughs start to return, is Act 3, right? But it brought to mind, you know, for me, the one through line, because we talked about this a lot, was that The Lady Killers is almost like 3 different movies. It's definitely 2 different movies. Act 3 is not just textually and subtextually a different movie, but it's photographed entirely in a different way altogether.
Right.
The editing is totally different. But I could make a case that each act is a different film in some ways. But what is the through line, obviously, is this darkly comedic tone. And if someone follows that tone, well, then it's going to lead you to the understanding that, okay, there is a satirical target in each of these different films. And what is that target? Well, but that maybe is upon, you know, more, you know, multiple viewings and reflection. You start to do that kind of analysis of something. But in terms of the visceral immediate reaction to things, it's really interesting because what it meant was, in some unconscious way, he recognized and approved of our target in the first 2 acts.
Oh, cool.
And therefore, it's comedy that works.
Right.
And in some way, either did not recognize or did not approve of our target in the 3rd act. And therefore, the comedy doesn't work. And because we're making fun of tropes just as much in the 3rd act as we are in the first 2 acts. It's just tropes of a different nature. It's this idea that violence resolves things. But a lot of people want violence to be able to resolve things. That's what brings them catharsis. So to make fun of that might off-put some viewers.
Huh. That is fascinating. Well, that makes a lot of sense then. If he recognizes and appreciates 2 out of 3 targets, well, right there. That's a 66% approval rating.
Yeah, that's a D letter grade. All right. But what I loved about it and what I appreciate about it is, that it is a review that contributes to the conversation.
Yeah.
And that's fucking why we made it. So anyway.
Exactly. And now Film Threat has gone full circle. The existential crisis in film is over. You're now.
Thank God it's over. Thank God it's over. It's worth revisiting again why that. But I do think that it's... I do think it has something to do with, even back then, with Party Crashers.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still kind of making fun of things.
Interesting.
But the darkness and the way I was making fun was much more gentle.
Right.
And
not pointed.
And so it's interesting how much that pissed people off. Whereas the Lady Killers, it's not gentle, but it disturbs a lot more people. It doesn't please as many people, but it also doesn't seem to piss people off nearly as much. So it's really interesting. And I continue to work a pace at as much as I can without being able to see what I'm doing on Truth Is Out There too. I just finished a reel of the film that is like 19 minutes long, all about the Templars. And boy, it covers some ground. I mean, we got the Templars, we got the Priory of Sion, we've got Mary Magdalene, we've got St. John the Baptist, we've got the Ark of the Covenant, we've got Tesla, we've got the, we're covering some ground in that, as you would expect.
Are we interviewing Dan Brown? What are we doing?
We did a piece on Dan Green.
No, Dan Brown, the author.
I know.
But anyway. Yeah,
but we did a piece on Dan Green, the author, who uses that name as a tongue-in-cheek poke to the side of Dan Brown. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, the Lincoln Da Vinci Code is covered in there.
Oh.
So anyway, it's going to be, I think it's going to be really fun.
Awesome.
This movie.
Particularly because you're blind and you're editing. That's really cool too.
Oh God. It was so great that one day I came back when they numbed me and opened the pupils all the way. And I came back and I could see it and I go, oh my God, this is what the movie looks like. This is great. And then I started to weep as hours went by in my eyesight. I do think that process was one of the reasons that the eyesight's deteriorated so much.
What, you're editing?
No, that test where they opened, numbed me and opened the pupils all the way permanently, and then
right, fucked it up. Yeah, and then you still don't wear sunglasses in UV sunshine, do you?
I have to wear the basically kind of this film, like the negative strip. Like film negative, I have to wear it over in order to go outside, or else like I'm walking on the surface of the sun.
Hilarious.
No, I mean I'm singing that Smash Mouth song, whatever the. All right. Okay, we're halfway through this show. We gotta open the Chill Pack morgue.
Oh, let's do the morgue.
Celebrity deaths.
So let's start with Barbara Perry, not an icon of the 1960s, but she played Maury Amsterdam's wife, Pickles, on a couple of episodes of the Dick Van Dyke Show. And quite frankly, if you played 2 episodes is enough. If you played a recurring part on the Dick Van Dyke Show, you get mentioned on your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
That's exactly right. 'Cause I recall seeing her, yes, I rewatched the entire Dick Van Dyke series recently on Netflix. And Yes, Pickles. Okay, yeah.
Well,
I'm picturing her.
I wish I knew this woman, because 97 years old, she dies. And how great is to read a biography, an obituary, where it says, died from natural causes. I don't know the last time I saw that.
I know. What are natural causes?
So, being born. It's a death warrant. So she continued to act. I mean, she was in episodes of How I Met Your Mother. She was on Baskets.
Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't realize this.
You would love this. She was a renowned tap dancer who headlined nightclub acts, including a long-running gig at the Coconut Grove.
Wow. As a tap dancer?
Yeah.
Who? I would never think that you have a career in saloon joints tap dancing.
Wow. Gregory Hines, were he still alive, would have a thing or two to say.
But he did Broadway. I mean, he was like, they did, you know, Bring On the Funk and Bring On the Noise. Those were big tap dancing shows. You never saw somebody in a smoky tavern tap dancing, you know, in between stand-up acts.
I am, I'm going to make a case that this next person is also iconic.
Okay.
Jim Fowler. I got nothing. Yeah. I get nothing from you, Jim Fowler. Now, was, when you were a boy.
Okay.
Was Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom a thing in Canada?
Oh, yeah, sure was. Yeah. Up until the Fifth Estate, the investigative news TV show blew that wide open.
What are you talking about?
Their technique of getting footage of tranquilizing or shooting a zebra and then tranquilizing a lion and its archenemy to think that the zebra is both theirs, and then let the cameras roll when these two animals try to come and collect the zebra, and a big fight ensues. This was Mutual of Omaha's method of collecting exciting, dramatic nature footage.
I don't agree. Jim Fowler was the longtime host. He started as the co-host with Marlon Perkins. Perkins was always in studio. And now let's go to Jim, who's down the river wrestling a water buffalo, right?
Right. And, yeah, that's always the joke.
And then he took over as the sole host when Perkins retired in 85. And he was the one that did the physical work on the show, such as wading into crocodile-infested water. It was dangerous. There were no tranquilizers being used. He was a wildlife correspondent for the Today Show. It doesn't get more legitimate than that.
Yeah.
He was a popular frequent guest on Johnny Carson's Tonight Show. Would that have been possible if your Fifth Estate expose had been true? No. And Conan. God. Conan. Like, Conan adds legitimacy. He was on Conan. All right. He also...
Look, I'm not saying he's not legitimate. I'm just saying that some of the techniques they used were circumspect.
I'm sure it was. And
you know, lemmings don't commit suicide. You know, that was faked.
Well, I also think that, you know, he spent his life as a leading figure for wildlife conservation, right?
Right. Great work.
He designed Cheeha Park Wildlife Animal Park in his hometown of Albany, Georgia. He, by the way, he was 87 years old when he died.
What did he die of? Lion attack? Alligator? Rabies? What did he get?
I think shame over that expose. Really? But I do think that you're right. I do think that, you know, the rules have changed. Some people, you know, we're made to hold account. Like, it's all well and good. You want to bring information and concern and compassion for the wild kingdom to a mass audience. But perhaps you ought to apply more compassion and respect and concern in how you bring those stories to bear in the first place. Right?
Right. Absolutely. And, you know, if you've ever tried to photograph even a bird, you know, how time-consuming it is, how much patience it requires, and to have a weekly show that has exciting footage every time is going to require some manipulation somehow, is all I'm saying.
I feel like we've been taking an audio snapshot of a bird weekly for 12 full years. And by the way, Dean, this starts year 13 of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. How about me burying the lead?
There you go. Happy anniversary.
Well, anniversary was last week, but but you know, we're into year 13. I mean, this is our
lucky 13.
Oh my God, we should, when we turn 13 on our 13th anniversary. Oh, I'm thinking there's going to be a bar mitzvah.
No. When our show becomes a man.
Oh my God, we should have I don't know. Is this offensive? Is this in poor taste? Would it be wrong to have a rabbi come on and do a blessing?
Probably, but you know, there's other.
We won't tranquilize him to get a good photo. I mean, we'll treat him with respect. And
that's terrible.
All right, let's wrap up Jim Fowler with a quote of his, because this is certainly what. I'm sure he would want the kind of point of view that he would want to be remembered for. Almost all of the social tragedies occurring around the world today are caused by ignoring the basic biological laws of nature. The quicker we humans learn that saving open space and wildlife is critical to our welfare and our quality of life, maybe we'll start thinking of doing something about it.
Hooray!
Did you see that Bill Nye, the science guy, explained climate change?
I did see that clip with the blowtorch on the globe.
Yeah, the planet's fucking on fire.
Yeah, that one.
All right.
That's pretty funny. And I also saw The Art Life, finally.
Okay, well, this will be a great segue because our final august personage that we need to pay tribute to is none other than Margaret Ann Lipton. Like so many named Margaret, the nickname was Peggy, and that was the name Peggy she Lipton. Went by as an actress, model, and singer, well known. Again, I don't know, this show is kind of forgotten to a degree because it was such a you know, of its time. But at its time, the Mod Squad was iconic.
Right. And what a great name, the Mod Squad.
I know.
You got to love that.
I mean, how can we not be that for our podcast? Can we? The Chill Pack Mod Squad. Oh, my God.
I'm so mod.
Maybe that's if we have fans, maybe that could be the fan club, the Chill Pack Mod Squad. for which, so the Mod Squad got Peggy Lipton a Golden Globe Award for Best Actress, by the way, in 1970. She had a 50-year career in television, film, and stage, a fascinating woman. I could go on and on and on about her, but you know, she wrote a memoir. She was really attracted to in her youth after Paul McCartney, who apparently bored her as a romantic partner. She then just went after alcoholic, abusive men until you know, settling down with the man that she would marry, Quincy Jones. And who would be the father of her two daughters, including Rashida Jones, the actress, Parks and Recreation. You know, she was a singer and had three songs that charted on the Billboard charts. None of them became hits. But how about this for a biographical entry? Quick trivial question, Dean. What's the official song of Los Angeles? Yes, Los Angeles. Has an official song, not Hotel California.
Hotel California?
No. You can check in anytime you like, but you can never leave. No. Exactly. What's our anthem here in Los Angeles? We have an official song. We needed to adopt one for the 1984 Olympic Games, for crying out loud.
Oh, right.
And no, it's not I Love L.A., which so many people think it is, and you got to love L.A. for this reason. Randy Newman writes a song mocking Los Angeles called I Love L.A., and we love it. We think that it says how great we are. And we sing it at every sporting event. It's making fun of us, people, but anyway.
But we also sing Short People Have No Reason. And people think that's a real song, too.
And we still, for some reason, think that he should be doing songs for movies, like You Got a Friend in Me. Dear God, I would gladly go deaf if it meant I didn't have to hear a Randy Newman song ever again. Anyway, the point that I want to make is the official song of Los Angeles, orchestrated by Quincy Jones and his big band, is the Frank Sinatra song, L.A. Is My Lady.
Oh.
And one of the three writers of that song was none other than Peggy Lipton.
Come on.
Yeah. Peggy Lipton is one of the authors of the official song of Los Angeles. That is quite the biographical footnote. I defy anyone to tell me otherwise. All right. I mentioned her history with alcoholic abusive men. This seems to me to be quite the jumping off point for certainly Mark Frost, David Lynch's co-creator on Twin Peaks, in terms of writing storylines for her character, Norma Jennings, in Twin Peaks. And, you know, she revised that role in Twin Peaks, The Return, looked every bit as beautiful as she did 25 years earlier when she first played the role. This was stunning to me that she died. I know she dies of cancer at 72, but what an ethereal beauty this woman was. And it's really, I'm so glad that of all the characters that Lynch agreed to give a happy ending to in The Return, because most he did not.
That's right.
But he let Norma Jennings finally get together with the erstwhile love of her life in Twin Peaks The Return. It was satisfying when I saw it, and it's so much more satisfying now. And indeed, I don't know if I would be able to watch her stuff again in the wake of her death if they did not end up together. It would just be too much. So Peggy Lipton, 72 years of age. Now, what a segue to David Lynch, The Art Life, the documentary about David Lynch, the painter.
Right. Well, and the filmmaker, though.
Filmmaker, but kind of sideways, right?
Yeah, because, as he said, I wanted paintings that moved.
Yeah, I wanted motion paintings. And also, because he gets biographical in a way that I've never heard him before.
Absolutely.
It does inform your understanding of some of his films, some of his choices, some of the material he's drawn to, in a way that he would never open up when talking about his movies. But in talking about the art life, he's not interpreting his own paintings, obviously. It's not like he's taking a different approach to interpreting his painting than he would towards a film. No, he wants that to be a viewer's experience.
Right.
But he will talk about what it means to him to be a painter.
But even there, I mean, more to my shock was how specific certain memories were to him. You know, how he could, down to the detail of moving away from Idaho, I guess it was, where Mr. Smith and they're all standing around that tree, and, you know, the tree where he played in the mud. All of those memories, he created such a very specific image that you can see that sort of replicate in a lot of his movies. That made me suddenly appreciate some of the stuff that I always thought was shitty. You know, Lost Highway, your favorites, Mulholland Drive, those ones. Now,
which I now am willing to say are the two best, by the way.
Whatever.
Well, I mean, Mulholland Drive was a masterpiece the moment it got delivered. You're on the wrong side of history on that conversation.
Forget it.
But I've always been and this is not bandwagon jumping. You know this. I have always been a big advocate that Lost Highway is the truly underrated work that he did. that was ahead of its time, and that when I watched it on the big screen again recently, you know, within the last few years, handful of years, and made the mistake of sitting right behind Moby in the movie theater. So afterwards, countless people would come up and tell me how much they liked my music. Because we bear a little bit of a resemblance, and they just look, they go, look, there's Moby. And then, you know, in the dark, you know, you get mixed up. And so suddenly it's
congratulations.
Yeah. Yes. So anyway, but it's a film about time travel. And when I realized that it was one of the great science fiction time travel pieces ever made, it not only, opened up new avenues of exploration of that film emotionally, but really prepared me for Twin Peaks: The Return.
And what this has done for me is two things. One, it seemed very depressing to me, in that it seemed Eraserhead was what he's been trying to get back to his entire career. The joy of having a horse stable for 4 years, creating, living the art life. He was living, he had, you know, the film gave him the horse stable at the Greystone Mansion and where he shot Eraserhead. And to my mind, watching the documentary, it's all about getting back to that creative thing.
Yeah. And you know, that's why I don't know if we'll ever see a feature length film from him again. I consider, as you know, Twin Peaks: The Return a movie, not a TV show.
Right. But
to call it feature length at 17 hours, you know, I mean, I guess anything over 90 minutes or 45 minutes, whatever the fuck the definition is, it's feature length. But you know what I mean? I think Lost, Inland Empire, which I absolutely detest, is the last film that I'll ever make. And it's interesting that you say it, because while you were describing that, I was going, God, that is what he was doing in Inland Empire. He was trying to make Eraserhead again.
Right.
And now, because of digital cinema, he could afford everything. And he could afford the time, and he could do everything himself, and he could... And it's so easy to see the limitations of the technology in terms of that movie. But in reality, from the creative process, he had no limitations, and that's the problem.
Right.
Whereas, you know, those 4 years spent in the barn at AFI making by hand the entire world.
Yeah.
Imbued.
And having a world to create.
Yes.
Even that, you know, he's saying that in his painting, he's continually just doing it to find it, but he's not finding it, it seems, lately.
Well, but I think also, you know, you really like, you know, it's interesting because Eraserhead speaks to you in a way that a lot of his other stuff doesn't,
right?
And yet, you know, your criticism of him, well, he's throwing spaghetti against the wall. Well, that criticism would apply to that movie more than any of his others, if that's really the problem. So there's something about it that really hooks you emotionally. And I think what it is maybe when we talk about how important it is to do things in camera, right? You know, Raiders of the Lost Ark versus Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. Never mind the story being better, but also this idea that you're seeing things either actually happen or things that are made by humans by hand. And
created,
therefore they have both a certain verisimilitude, but also they have weight. And that includes an emotional weight to them. And, and anything, if you're going to go through that amount of time, even if your aim is, well, I need to find it. If you're going to go through that amount of time in order to try and find it, that thing is imbued with love.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Because there's a connection. There's an organic connection that, and I think it's that organicness.
Yeah, absolutely.
That I find missing when I criticize because spaghetti against the wall that's inorganic then becomes not just flat but desperate, whereas a razor head seems to have something deeper because the world is so not just thought through, it's organically grown.
And the organic nature of his emotional connection. So that's the thing in the art life that's so amazing. When he's talking about Philadelphia and he's talking about Pittsburgh, you know, and he's talking about, you know, his relationship to these places, dear God, that's what he's creating in Eraserhead. So he has an organic emotional connection to it. And as he does even in Blue Velvet. Boy, when he's telling those stories of childhood. Well, he even talks about the naked woman appearing out of the middle of nowhere.
I mean, middle of nowhere.
And that's, but just, again, the organic emotional connection to it. And and that's why, though it didn't work for you, it worked for many of us, and especially for women. Mulholland Drive, the innate organic, you know, where he almost became championed in a weird way as a feminist, because he really was connected in some way to some, you know, organic emotional process in that film. Anyway, so, but did you also see similarities with yourself that disturbed you?
Oh, good Lord, the childhood drawings of tanks and airplanes. I got books. We look like we're drawing the same fucking thing at the exact same time in our lives. That's the weirdest thing. You know, that took my breath away for sure. So, yeah, now that I see more similarities between him and I don't know if if I have to go watch them all again, or was it my self-loathing that was making me criticize all his films in the first place?
Am I making this up, or did we learn in that movie that he played drums?
You might be making that up, but no. No, he was a drummer, wasn't he?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. Just like Dean Haglund.
I know. I know. What a weird path we both have taken.
All right. I also saw this week, I watched it multiple times because, again, it's not easy for me, so I have to adjust. But I watched multiple times because I really loved it, and I wanted to be able to take it in visually as much as I could. A movie that I think was really underrated, and it's rare to be able to say that for a movie that got an Oscar nomination, but it didn't make any top 10 lists that I saw. And it was Julian Schnabel's Vincent van Gogh film At Eternity's Gate.
Oh.
That Willem Dafoe got a Best Actor nomination for this year.
Really?
And I just adore this film.
Right. Is this the one that's done digitally to look like the paintings of Van Gogh?
I guess they say that. I mean, I think it's much more you're put in how he sees and hears the world. You know, I can't swear to it, but I think he's suggesting that Van Gogh had cataracts. But then again, I'm watching it through cataracts. So everybody is making that movie right now. But like, you know, he bought these old pair of bifocals that had, you know, the bottom lens were for up close viewing and the top lens half was for distance viewing. And he shot the whole movie with that kind of lens, that kind of diopter. You know, choose one focal length and everything else would have this texture to it. But it's not a biopic. It's about what his creative process was in the final days of his life. You know, Van Gogh produced 75 canvases in the final 82 days of his life.
Yeah, almost a masterpiece a day.
And
I mean, think of that.
And it's about what brought him there, what drove him to that, where he was in his creative process, in his headspace, how he heard things, how he saw things. It's a movie that might take a little bit of time to cast its spell, but it's so fantastic. I love this movie. And there is a scene at the end that is one of my favorite scenes in years. And really? It's after he has been institutionalized a second time at a church-run asylum. Right. He's let out he's let out of the straitjacket to have a conversation with the priest, played by the terrific Mads Mikkelsen. I mean, all these character actors that are coming in. Matthew Almerich, of course, who had played the lead in The Diving Bell and the Butterfly for Julian Schnabel 10 years right. earlier, one of our top films of last decade. He has a wonderful, wonderful turn in this. But Mads Mikkelsen plays the priest that he has to meet with, who has to decide whether or not they can let him go. And right. they have a wonderful conversation about why do you think you're a painter? You know, if you've never sold anything, why do you think that? What does it mean to be a born painter? Why? So you're saying God gave you a gift in order to make you suffer. And so it's this wonderful, wonderful thing. And what comes out of it is all of Van Gogh's knowledge of scripture. And
because he was a preacher before painting.
And son of a preacher.
Yeah.
And so it's a wonderful conversation. And what's great is I'm sitting here thinking, holy shit, this is transporting me right back to the best scene in Last Temptation of Christ, where Willem Dafoe is sitting there talking to Pontius Pilate, who has to cast judgment. David Bowie in an amazing performance, right? That scene lives on in my memory, no matter how long it is between viewings of it. And this scene is every bit its equal and its counterpart. And damn if Van Gogh doesn't bring up Christ's meeting with Pilate in the scene itself.
Wow. That's hilarious.
And then to just sit there and to be able to appreciate in that moment Willem Dafoe's career.
Right.
That, of course, the man who played Christ would play Van Gogh. How could that not happen? How could that not be part of the arc?
And that's actually really good casting, because there is a physical similarity, facial similarity.
There is. And it's Dafoe is such a fascinating career. And really, I think it is safe to say that maybe he's undervalued, that he's underappreciated, been underrated. You know, he plays villains a lot because he plays madness so well. But Van Gogh, Christ, these are not villains. But madness is a part of what makes them heroic. But at the same time, he plays, maybe that's one of the reasons why Florida Project was such a beautiful, beautiful movie, is that he can play the grace of ordinary people trying to do the right thing more compellingly than almost anybody else.
And he came out of that experimental theater group, the Wooster Group.
Oh.
So he was a proponent of not just experimental theater, but there was also a lot of improv, a lot of street. They would order delivery that would come on. The delivery guy would come on stage in a lot of shows because their theater was on Wooster Street, and technically the back of the stage was the garage door to the sidewalk. So often, as a way of ending these myriad of shows, they would just open the garage door and everybody would walk out on the sidewalk, and then the audience just left by themselves in the theater.
Wow.
I know, right?
Cool now, I've written that down. I don't think I knew that about him. And there is a quote that he has in one of the behind-the-scenes documentaries about his process as an actor. And it's really breathtaking in how simply he conveys it, but in the complexity of what he's looking for. And of the playground he's building. And it is that of an experimental artist, not of what you hear from most process-based actors.
Right.
And Dean Haglund, you need to find this.
Where did you find it?
I watched it on Blu-ray at Eternity's Gate, Julian Schnabel.
Eternity's Gate.
Out now.
Now.
Wherever Blu-rays can be found. I watched... I, I'm going to give these short shrift because they're neither of them are worth more than that. But I also watched Mark Forster. What a weird career that guy's had. He did, why he's chosen to do the live action Winnie the Pooh movie, Christopher Robin, I have no idea. He works very hard to not be cynical, but I would have preferred a cynical movie over just a milquetoast movie that happens for 100 minutes. But I offer this to people who have seen Mary Poppins Returns and Christopher Robin. One casting choice change could have made both movies infinitely better. Ben Whishaw should not have played in the grown-up Banks boy in Mary Poppins Returns. It should have been Ewan McGregor, who looked like the kid. And Ben Whishaw should play grown-up Christopher Robin.
Wow.
Both movies better through one trade in casting. You're welcome, America. I also watched the award hopeful that got no award nominations and no top 10 lists because, boy, dear God, the well-meaning, heartfelt, beautiful boy starring Timothy Chalamet and Steve Carell, based on a true story about the journalist whose son he thinks he knows so well is an addict on every drug imaginable, but especially enjoys crystal meth. And every trope you can imagine gets checked off the list in earnest, yeah, earnest fashion in this movie. And I swear to God, just the first 30 minutes were jabbed into my arm like a rusty needle.
Oh my gosh, that good, eh? You know, I saw the trailer for this. I thought this has, I have no want to see this story. I, you know, so I didn't. Now I'm glad I didn't.
Yeah, I mean, there's no shortage. There will never be. It's not like we have too many movies about this. This is a topic that, you know, can be explored. I mean, as right, many individuals as there are individual stories to it. So why are we checking off all the tropes?
Well, do we know they're tropes, or, you know, are they tropes because they're true? That's also, you hear that quite often, right? It actually happens. So it's not stereotypical if it is the actual thing that occurs.
Yeah, and if it prevents one young person from trying it, wasn't it worth it?
I don't know.
I don't know, because I'm shooting up just to make it through the movie. Which,
that's terrible.
Brings me to, I mean, we're over time, but a little bonus Valentine, a bonbon of sorts, since it's start of year 13. The movie that I saw was this thing called Avengers Endgame. Have you heard of it?
Yeah, I think so. Tell me more.
It had the fourth best domestic third weekend of all time. You got that? That's a lot of numbers. Fourth best third weekend of all time, after having the second best second weekend of all time and the first best first weekend of all time. It's the third all-time domestic hit, passing last year's Black Panther, and by next weekend, it will pass Avatar for number two. Will it pass Force Awakens? Doubtful. Doubtful, but number two is fine. It's the number two film internationally already, and worldwide, it's the second biggest hit of all time, and it will pass Avatar. And I saw it. I saw as much of it, you know, it took about a half hour, I must admit, before I could actually start seeing it. I was trying on so many different glasses and shields and lens combinations and things and adjusting to it. But I finally could get to it. And, you know, I know who the characters are and I knew what the story was. So it wasn't like I was missing anything. But that is a bit of a, I must say, a...
backhanded compliment?
No, not a backhanded compliment. I mean, it's just to acknowledge that, you know, I couldn't be drawn into it the way that other people might. So it's a caveat of sorts. But, you know, it as we talked about with the first one was really quite, to me, just a cynical, distasteful cash grab about let's fuck everything up and kill and destroy everything. And then we can offer you the feel good. for an arbitrary decision we made to kill everything off in the first place. So it's 3 hours of broken up into hours. Act one, getting the surviving team back together. Act two, going back in time to get the Infinity Stones so that in Act three, we can snap our fingers and undo what was done by a snap of the fingers in the first one. Okay. I would gladly travel the quantum realms, go back in time to every harrowing world and era, risk life and limb and all that I love to be able to get those Infinity Stones so that I could bring them home and snap my fingers and get my 3 fucking hours back.
You didn't like it.
This... the mental illness that has swept over our nation and the world, apparently.
And the world.
People sobbing, I've heard, in the theater
because
of what happens to superheroes. Yeah, because they're... it is what it is, man. It's breads and circuses. I do appreciate that they deal with the concept of time travel in a novel way and a more realistic quantum way than any other movie ever has. And it's big and it's hardworking and there's some fine performances and there's some humor, of course. And if people love these characters and it brings them joy to see these, then good for them. But boy, 12 years, every major star in the business, billions of dollars on budgets, less than the sum of its parts? Is that fair to say? Feeling underwhelmed? This is the story that for 12 years you wanted to tell? It's a three-dimensional chessboard, is what it is. And isn't that kind of, at their worst, kind of what you feared all of the Marvel Cinematic Universe was? We're just trying to get pieces into place to set up what is literally called the end game.
Right. Yeah.
And it's about moving pieces around the board.
It's a product locomotive. I mean,
it's not story that comes out of character. The Marvel movies, when they work best, they are stories that come out of character. There's something we're exploring in these. And they're often the movies that are kind of outliers. Right? A Thor 3, an Iron Man 3. There's a moment at the end where everybody's at a memorial for one of the characters, and you see all the actors or CGI versions of them, of all the actors who have inhabited this universe. And they all look so glum, but not glum like they're at a funeral, glum like this is why we got into acting.
This is the sum of all.
Yeah. It'll be really interesting for me to see where Chris Evans goes from here. I mean, I think this is a guy that probably wants to do some meaningful work, but I don't know if it's going to come his way. And obviously, you know, Robert Downey Jr. has the next Sherlock Holmes, so he's got another big payday. But it'll be interesting to see what kind of roles he wants to play. Or does he want to? Or is he going to just kind of shuffle off towards retirement? Be a dad? I mean, I don't know. But the one who really the world seems to be his oyster is Chris Hemsworth.
Oh, yeah.
Surprisingly, the guy that seemed maybe to have the least going for him in terms of a diverse career when these movies started. Especially because, let's face it, Thor, you wouldn't think on paper, is the one that's going to be the showcase.
Yeah.
But he is such a gifted comedic actor. He has always actually had quite a depth emotionally, going back to playing Kirk's dad in J.J. Abrams' first Star Trek movie.
Right, yeah.
This guy could really... You know, we could be thinking about him when he's in his 50s the way we think about Tom Cruise, or maybe more to the point, maybe a Brad Pitt. You know, someone who uses his stardom. Not that there wasn't a time when Tom Cruise didn't use his stardom to make really interesting and thoughtful movies, but now he's kind of in still the game of proving that a 50-something can still make tentpole movies.
Right, actions.
But your Clooney's, your Brad Pitt's.
Right.
Chris Hemsworth could end up having that kind of career.
That'd be something. I would like to see that, actually.
Anyway.
Now you say that.
All right. That's it. That's 70 That's it. Minutes to start year 13.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Check out some of our shows at chillpackhollywood.com. We continue to add more of them. But obviously, we're available on Blog Talk Radio, every show we've ever done. And you can subscribe via iTunes so that you never miss a week. You can also subscribe on Stitcher, quite frankly. I don't know how one does that, but some people, I think, do.
Please do. That's easy. And you can email us. We're at chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. And follow us on Twitter and Instagram. Dean and Phil. Spell out the word and.
Absolutely. We had a very, very funny 12th anniversary photo.
Hilarious. I'll have to look at it.
Oh, you posted it, so I'm glad that you'll now look at it. All right.
Do it blindly.
Just like, what do they call it? Solidarity.
That's right. I Instagram with my eyes closed.
13, the year of solidarity.
Till next week, I'm Dean Haglund.
I'm Phil Ernest. See you then.
Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.